For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So, welcome. Thank you for coming out tonight and showing up here tonight. There's a bunch of people who are at a Branching Streams conference, and I think, you know, just people are out of town, so it's really great to sit with you this evening, and it was really lovely to chant tonight. I don't know, something about it was really, really enjoyed that. So tonight I'm going to talk about a text that I went to a 7-day sesshin in Hokkyoji, which is in a retreat center in southeastern Minnesota. It's a really beautiful place. It's a place that has all this really interesting landscape because when the glaciers came down, they, for some reason, went around this area. It's southeastern Minnesota, so it would be, northeastern Iowa and Wisconsin. And so it has all this really, really interesting topography and that didn't get flattened by the glaciers. So it's kind of an interesting place. And I was sitting there with the Clouds and Water Sangha from the Twin Cities. So this is one of the texts that we read. I'll tell you more about that in a second. But at the end of the sesshin, they did something interesting. They had a circle where people shared out what they experienced. And there's, you know, some rules about confidentiality, who could speak, and, you know, how could you respond to people. But I found it really interesting because of one of the, rules or guidelines they had. And it was trust emergence. Trust emergence. So whatever is arising, trust that. And so they said, like, if you you can plan to say something, but really just speak from your heart, I think is what it's talking about. Whatever is emerging, just say it. So that really stuck with me, in addition to some other things. And I've just been living with that idea of, like, oh, trust emergence. And tonight was actually kind of an example of that because we didn't have a dough on. And then Michael emerged. So I don't know. I've been, like, it's been really interesting when just, like, stepping back and being like, okay, whatever's arising right now is going to take care of it. It's going to take care of itself. Things are going to be okay or not okay, you know, but whatever, just trust that. And so Aishin asked me to do a talk a couple weeks ago, and I was like, okay, what am I going to do a talk about? I was like kind of like rattling, figuring it out. And then I was on a long bike ride in Michigan, and I saw a lot of birds, like birds of prey, actually. I think kestrels, maybe. I don't know them that well. But then I saw a hawk, like, gliding over, like, very slowly. And in its talons, it had some kind of rodent. And as you'll see from this story, that sort of sparked my mind of, like, oh, that's what I'm going to give my talk about. So it's a really short text, actually. Can you pass them that way? I think. Jam. There you go. There's just one. Yeah, there you go. And the title of the story is The Hawk. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't really get this at first, and it didn't really speak to me. But it's one of those texts that, I don't know if you have had this happen before, where it kind of nags at you a little bit, and it keeps coming up, and you're like, what's going on with this? It comes from this book, Basic Teachings of the Buddha, which was sort of the central text of the sesshin. And again, this book is from, like, early Buddhist texts, which I don't always initially, it takes me a while to get into them, for sure. It's not like reading Song of the Grass Hut or one of these poems that I really, like, just speak to me. These are, like, often repetitive things. There's, like, you know, lots of lists and things like that. But for some reason, this one has stuck with me. So I'll read the first half and then say a few things and then maybe get your thoughts, and then we'll read the second half. So this is called The Hawk. The Buddha related this story to a group of his followers. Once, in the distant past, a hawk suddenly swooped down and seized a quail. Have you ever seen a quail before? Yeah, they're kind of, they're a little small. They're kind of comical looking because of the shapes of their bodies and the way they move. They have that little thing. I don't know, I always think of them a little comically. They are like darting around, so. So anyway, the hawk swooped down and seized a quail. As the quail was being carried away by the hawk, it lamented, "How unfortunate I am! What little merit I possess to have wandered out of my natural habitat into a foreign domain. If I had wandered within my native domain today, within my own ancestral natural habitat, this hawk would certainly not have been a match for me in battle." What is your native domain, quail? What is your own ancestral natural habitat? Asked the hawk. The quail answered, "That clod of earth, freshly tilled with a plow." Then the hawk, not boasting about its own strength, not mentioning its own strength, released the quail, saying, "Go, quail, but having gone there, you cannot escape me." Then the quail, having gone to the clod of earth, freshly tilled with a plow, climbed onto the large clod of earth and, standing there, said to the hawk, "Come get me now, hawk, come get me now." Now the hawk, not boasting about its own strength, not mentioning its own strength, folded up its wings and suddenly swooped down on the quail. When the quail fully realized that the hawk was coming, it got inside that clod of earth, and the hawk, striking against it, suffered a blow to its chest. So I'm going to stop there for a second. I'm a little baffled by this story. To me, when I first read it, it's like, what is going on here? Like, there's a... You kind of think that the quail is going to get it in the end, because he's like, he's boasting, right? And I don't know. So this story, and like, you kind of think, okay, the hawk is maybe death, and I don't know, this story kind of baffled me, and I'm not even sure it's even a story, really. It's like, there's no, like, I don't know, but in any case, it was like, it's kind of an interesting, there's some interesting things in here that I've been playing with. For example, what is your natural habitat? And what is foreign domain? What does that mean? Like, the hawk asks this, what is your native domain? What is your own ancestral natural habitat? And the quail is really upset that he has left this. And this reminded me a little bit of Dogen's Fukan Zazengi, when he says, the way is never apart from this place, from this very place. What's the use of traveling around to practice? So this quail is kind of like saying, realizing this, like, why should I, what am I doing out of my natural domain? And then later Dogen says, why leave behind the seat in your own home and wander in vain through the dusty realms of other lands? So that's the foreign domain, I guess, is what maybe what he's saying there. Now my first reaction to this story was a little bit like, is this really a story just about, okay, play it safe, stay at home, and everything's going to be all right? I guess you could maybe say that, but both the Buddha, who told this story, and Dogen, both wandered a lot outside of their home countries. The Buddha wandered for 40 or something years all around India. He never really had a home. So he knew about wandering around. So thinking about that, what was his ancestral home? What is his native domain? And Dogen also wandered a lot. He says, you know, don't leave the seat in your home, in your own home. And that's always kind of confused me, because he actually did a lot of traveling too. He traveled to China when it was very dangerous to do so. And he traveled there for years and then came back to Japan. So I've always wondered, like, what is this home that they're talking about? What is this natural domain? And then the other part that I think is interesting is that the quail's home is the earth. There's something about that that I thought was interesting, that he goes and hides in the earth. And that protects him. So the next little part, and then I want to hear what you your reactions to this strange story are. So then the story, then the Buddha goes on to say, so it is when someone wanders out of his or her natural habitat into a foreign domain. Therefore, do not wander out of your natural habitat into a foreign domain. Death will gain access to the person who has wandered out of his or her natural habitat into a foreign domain. Death will gain a footing. Death is kind of a strong word there, huh? That also makes it seem like, oh, don't leave your home because death is coming for you, right? But I don't think that's what's going on here. In the book that he translates death, he says that the Buddha the Buddha uses death a lot of times. It's the word Mara in Pali. He uses the word Mara more idiosyncratically. So he's not maybe talking about death necessarily, but he says more. Mara is the insidious, impulsive, grasping tendency of every normal human being. So that's kind of interesting. The insidious, impulsive, grasping tendency of every normal human being. Because I kind of thought of the hawk as kind of like death swooping down any moment to take us away. And I guess in a sense, that's always the case, right? Death is around us all the time. I'm seeing all these dead cicadas everywhere, you know, and dead animals on the road, and it's not me that's dying, right? So there's not really death, right? It's kind of, I think that's my own delusion, but I think death is everywhere already. So, so what are your reactions? Before we move on to the second part, do you have any reactions to this text? Anything that you think is, like, my first reaction to this was a little like, what? Or any thoughts that you have? Or yeah.
Reading a book by scholar James Scott called Against the Grain, and he talks about the end of hunter-gatherers and the beginning of agrarian civilization. And think about the period in which this story came to life. It was this period of crisis where the agrarian system had proven to create all sorts of ills and no one knew the answers to them. Mm-hmm. What I find really strange about the story is that it's telling the bell to return to tiller. Right? Mm. Don't go outside of agricultural lands. Go back to the tilder, hide in the tilder. And that surprises me that would be the motif that plays through the story.
Yeah.
In that time, people could escape agriculture. They could get away from slavery. They could run off into the hills. And that was a very viable option for people in this period. So I find it interesting that we would be asking people to return to that system that created those ills. Mm. So for me, I'm not sure what to make of that. That motif puzzles me.
Yeah. Yeah, when I read this part about the field, actually I thought of it like in Hongzhe, he talks about the oh my gosh, I'm forgetting the title.
Cultivating
the empty field. So there's the field of emptiness, and so so that's what I thought. But yeah, you're right. This story does come from that time, so it would be interesting or puzzling that would be the case. Yeah. Wait.
Well, it seems like our native domain is present. Hmm. No matter where we are, it's the present. And it's not so much that the present has to be cultivated, but that our presence in the present is something that we humans seem to uniquely need to cultivate. Is inhabiting the present.
Mm-hmm.
Or cultivating our awareness of it, to use the very.
Yeah, I was thinking of two things along those lines. We just chanted the song of the Buddha's hut, and thinking about not separating from this skin bag.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I was thinking about from Gendo Khan, Dogen talks about, you know, if this bird or this fish tries to reach the end of its element without moving it, it will die at once. And how we try not to grasp outside of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that you say that, because I actually, that's one of the parts that made me think, that came up for me with this part. Can I read this part then? And it's like, so This is from Genjo Koan. So, and it says, when a fish swims, no matter how far it swims, it doesn't reach the end of the water. When a bird flies, no matter how high it flies, it cannot reach the end of the sky. And then, each fish and each bird uses the whole of space and vigorously acts in every place. Which I think is interesting to think about. Their native domain, their home, is this huge space. But then later, where is it? Where's the part about the... Oh, however, if a bird departs from the sky or a fish leaves the water, it immediately dies. We should know that for a fish, water is life. For a bird, sky is life. So I've actually often puzzled about that part until I thought about it in terms of like this native domain. So it's like your native domain, you stay there, that's where you thrive. And when you leave that, you die. I mean, I don't think literally, but I think there's something about it. And then later he says, when we make this very place our own, our practice becomes the actualization of reality. When we make this path our own, our activity naturally becomes actualized reality. So I think that's kind of what you're saying about cultivating this everything we do when we cultivate this place becomes actualized reality. Or, which means, which I looked this up to make sure, what Dogen means by this is the unity of practice, realization, and true reality manifesting as the present moment. Yeah, Michael.
My initial reaction was that it was metaphorical, or an allegory, mm-hmm. Because it's the same thing as your original self. So, I was also thinking of the first practice instruction from cultivating empty field, where the Siddha said, poetic sentence, of course, it's an English translation. I guess poetic sentence, a translation of the wonder into the center of the circle of wonder.
Can you say that again, sir?
To wonder into the center of the circle of wonder. The bright bottomless, boundless field.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't, it's not saying that, like, he doesn't wonder. He says, if I had wondered within my idea, he would have gone. Mm-hmm. So he's still, like, wandering around, just not, like, not wandering into something that that isn't true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People think it's sort of a slave quality until it's something about it. And I can't put any words in it, folks who are a very stable. And also because once it's been told, it's very specific.
Yeah, that's I hadn't thought. Oh.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too. It's just from farming and stuff. There are birds that, a lot of birds that hang around with the fields and they don't fly very much because they just hop around. And or what they do is they use the fields to lay their eggs for some reason. But it's the fact that though a lot of those, they're usually at, like, I don't really know this to be totally true, but I think they're in, like, soft stone kind of places, and places that are easy to pour into or to get safe hiding places. And so a lot of the, it may have been that the birds just sort of, once that kind of became prevalent or whatever, they just sort of adapted to, they would find how it feels because the ground is soft and they can pour into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, easily find the same data or whatever.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, yeah. Oh, cool, yeah.
Reading the gender expressing I know quails. They're eating many. You know what? The quails claiming that if I stayed in my native domain, I would be very powerful. And it seems to be a matter of power. If I stay in my native domain, I'm more powerful than the pod. But if I leave my native domain, I lose my power. So it seems to be just, you know, let's see. Within my own ancestral natural habitat, it's certainly not a better match for me in battle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's kind of like saying a parakeet to be a hawk. So that just seems to be an important part of it.
Yeah.
It's power, losing it and gaining it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when it goes back, there does be power as a hawk.
Mm-hmm.
It's the flat of earth.
He may have just gotten lucky too. Who knows?
Yeah.
I'm kind of thinking that way too. That there's a way in which, you know, if he'd stayed in his native domain, he couldn't have been pulled outside of himself to start thinking about, oh, how unfortunate I am. He might die, but he would just die.
I mean, if the field is the present moment and the hawk is death, right, then what gives us power over death, but staying in the present moment, right? And that's how tiny little creatures like us can fit off something much more powerful, because Dogen says the minute that the bird leaves the air, it dies, and of course goes to the hawk.
Yeah.
He leaves the air and runs straight to the ground.
It's so interesting. You mentioned that the word uses mara.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time actually I've heard mara translated as death.
Yeah.
Coming from when I first encountered Buddhist
courses,
Theravada traditions, which are a lot of Mara, it's interesting because I've only ever heard it as, it's also personified.
Mm-hmm.
It's a being who comes to visit you. And this tempter, it's like this, almost like a trickster god. It's just always beguiling people and is the source of all suffering and so on. It's all this samsara and all this. So, it's really interesting to think of it in terms of death.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, death is just another part of this. It adds a whole other layer to this sort of thing, making about Mara, this very traditional, you know, trickster sort of tempter figure in my head, because that's the sort of associations that I
have. That really reminds me of the movie The Little Buddha. A long time ago.
Yeah.
Sitting under the Bodhi tree. That's, you know, I hadn't thought about it for years, but Mara sends all these delusions that are very pleasing and so forth to him, and he just sits there and they all disappear. You know, fear and lust.
Sorry, I'm speaking. This reminded me that in that moment he touches the earth.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So it's really interesting that all these things that emerge from this story, a lot of them that I hadn't thought of when I read it. And so kind of to bring it back a little bit now to this last part here, like, what does this have to do with our practice? What does it have to do with sitting in zazen or responding to whatever happens in our lives in the world? That's kind of what I think of as practice. So we'll read a little bit, finish the rest of this. There's a part here where it's kind of repetitive. There's like a list. And so I'll just read the repetitive part towards the end. So now what is for you a foreign domain outside of your natural habitat? It is the The foreign domain is the fivefold realm of sensual pleasure. Which five? Forms, perceptible to the eye. Sounds, perceptible to the ear. Sense, perceptible to the nose. Tastes, perceptible to the tongue. And tactile objects, perceptible to the body, which are pleasing, desirable, charming, agreeable, arousing desire, and enticing. This is for you a foreign domain, outside of your natural habitat. Death will not gain access to the person who lives within his or her native domain, within his or her own ancestral natural habitat. Death will not gain a footing. Now, what is your native domain, your own ancestral natural habitat? It is the foundation of present moment awareness in four areas. What are the four areas? Now being ardent, fully aware, and mindful, and having put down longing and discontentment toward the world, live observing the body in and as the body, live observing feelings in and as feelings, live observing mind in and as mind, and live observing mental qualities and phenomena in and as mental qualities and phenomena. This is your native domain, your own ancestral natural habitat. So he gives kind of a picture there of like the foreign domain are the fivefold realm of sense pleasure. So it's like the senses, sight, sounds, taste, touch, that kind of thing. And what's interesting to me though is the native domain kind of has all those things in it. Because it's the body in and as the body, the feelings in and as the feelings, the mind in and as the mind. All of those five things, the sights, sounds, taste, touch, that's the only way we can really experience the world as human beings. I'm not sure, maybe I don't know of any other ones, but we have, right? I mean, like, so it's really interesting that the foreign domain and the native are so intertwined in this. Because usually when I read these things, oh, all these pleasing things, sight, sound, it's like, well, then what am I supposed to do? Like, I can't experience the world any other way. So what does he mean by that? Because it's kind of the same thing. So I think it's a way maybe of turning these into a way of awakening, turning these into some way that we can still be human beings, but live in a way that is not outside of our natural habitat. So I think obviously, first of all, this whole the four areas of present moment awareness. I mean, for me, I think of that. If that is home, then my first experience of sitting zazen and it has continued was this feeling of coming home. I don't know if anyone else has felt that way, but even though it was difficult and painful, like, actually, it wasn't that painful. It was just like very strange. But there was something about it that I felt like, oh, this is like, ah, okay, this is coming home. And like every time I sit, like there's still that sense of coming back somehow, of settling into my body. And I think that's what this is talking about here, settling into our body and just in. I thought also the wording of this was live observing the body in and as the body. I thought in and as are interesting there. And I thought of the song of the grass hut too, when it talks about how the hut contains the entire world. And so our bodies, this whole experience, it's our experience, but it also contains the entire world. And like you said, don't separate from the skin bag here and now. We, like, this native domain is the skin bag here and now. I think that's another way of saying all of this right here. And not stuck. And I think the way to understand this, what is the difference maybe, or the distinction between this idea of being not stuck to the sights, sounds, tastes, smells, maybe. And another, so zazen is one way. I've also been working a little bit with, I don't know if you guys know who Reggie Ray is. Have you heard of Reggie Ray? He was a student of Chögyam Trungpa, and he does a lot with, he calls it somatic meditation. So which is embodied meditation. And so he has a couple of guided meditations I've been doing before I sit that have been really interesting. And they're all about really being present with your body, starting with like your big toes and then going to the second toe. So it's like a, and then you imagine the tension that you feel in all these places just sinking into the earth. And so that's why I really like this part about the earth, because it's getting into back into our bodies is a way of also reconnecting with the earth, because for me anyway, often I'm not connected to the earth or my body. I'm up here, like spinning, discursive thinking and moving around. And so just before I sit, it's interesting to settle back into my body, feeling this, and it starts to feel like the earth is, when I've done this for a couple of months now, and it feels like the earth, when I do this practice, it's like this guided meditation, it's like very much like I'm sinking into the earth. I can feel it pulling for some reason. I mean, it could be my imagination, of course, but there's this really sense of like, oh, I'm really solid in the earth. And that's kind of what I thought of this quail, you know? That's kind of what it's like a little bit into this. And then what you were saying, Chris, about the fact it's like ready to accept seeds, you know? What are those seeds that could spring from this practice? Another thing that another one of Trungpa's students, Pema Chodron, she talks about a practice called compassionate abiding. And did I put the wrong one there? And so we're talking, I sometimes think about it like, oh, these pleasant experiences coming up, but really the things that arise are usually very unpleasant. The energies that pass through, the emotions, the feelings, all these things, like the feelings in and as the feelings, that's really difficult, I think, for me. Because I don't want to feel a lot of those feelings in and as the feelings, or the mind as the mind. I don't want to feel my body aching because I've been sitting too long or because I'm just getting old, you know? It's like, so I think it's interesting. So her practice of compassionate abiding is, it's like when you feel you're getting hooked by these habitual patterns or these feelings, is you breathe in, allowing the feeling completely and opening to it. The in-breath can be deep and relaxed. Anything that helps you let that feeling be there, anything that helps you not push it away. And that's interesting, because often when I'm doing zazen, sometimes I use the breath to push things away, for sure. It's subtle sometimes, but something comes up and I'm like, oh, I'm feeling it. Okay, I'm back to my breath. You know, instead of like just really letting that be present, let that feeling be in and as a feeling, I'm pushing it away. I'm kind of leaving my natural habitat when I do that. Then still abiding with the urge and edginess of feelings such as craving or aggression, as you breathe out, you relax and give the feeling space. The out-breath is not a way of sending this discomfort away, but of ventilating it, of loosening the tension around it and becoming aware of the space in which the discomfort is occurring. I think that word is really interesting, ventilating. Like it's just giving it a little, but not, because it's hard, it's very tricky. Like how do you ventilate it without then trying to push it away? Or how do I do that? That's tricky for me. But again, coming back to this idea of trust emergence, whatever that is, it's rising. It's supposed to arise, you know? It's supposed to be there, and it's time to look at it. It's time to like let that feeling be there, and as much as possible, breathing into it. And another way to say this, I think, too, is the Dogen's, another quote from Fukan Zazengi is to turn around, take the backward step and turn the light that shines within. To let that, give that some space. Take that backward step, give it some space and let it just be there. Or turn around the light to shine within, then just return from the grass hut, same thing. So, of your impressions of that passage, or Michael, you have the book open there. I'm wondering what's going on.
Well, I was thinking, I ended up because of what
talking about the field as the moment and the hawk is an expression of death. The mind's just talking to me and Joe Cohen. According to death is understood as that death, birth is an expression complete this moment, death is an expression complete this moment. Yes, it is. Which is kind of, it's also related, but some of what you're talking about, like non-separation. I was also looking to see if there was a case in here that Doug was talking about yesterday, because if you think about it, where, it's the case where Chacho, is that correct? Says, I'm paraphrasing grossly, but the ultimate way is without difficulty, simply stop referring one thing over another. Stop having preferences, basically, referring one thing over another. And then he goes on to say the student challenges him that he, that to stop referring one thing to another is to abide in clarity, that he does not abide in clarity. He says, well, if you do not abide in clarity, you can imagine your circumstances. He says, well, I don't know. But he's essentially saying that, like, you have to, you to some extent, one of the things that stuff or last thing I was thinking about today is, picking and choosing for one thing over another is going to happen. So, this clarity isn't like a stasis or whatever, where you leave behind picking and choosing. You continue to pick and choose, but you just don't, maybe you don't get lost in the fire of the man. You stay with it. That is that you can still pick and choose with an expression of non-separation. It's not like you're doing this or that or whatever. It's just like this is happening, or I choose this, but the result is out of my control or whatever. The risk of going on for too long. So it seems like just kind of saying, your natural habitat or whatever is what you can do. And I've been really kind of this four foundations of mindfulness that's been on my mind since from last summer. Because it came up and a number of times and I realized I didn't know what it was. I did a lot of contemplating body, that's kind of about where that's our natural habit. To take a deep breath. To make that was a deep breath. Short breath, say that was a short breath. Take a short breath, it's God feel anxious. I don't know, it's a weird thing, like how do you dwell contemplating feelings and feelings?
That's
simple exercise or some sort of fundamental truth, makes sense. I don't think about that. I don't throw my feelings on my stand that you're using to read the books or whatever, I see that stand, I recognize an object of mine, but I don't at the same time grasp it or think that I have, I understand that, that piece of what everything is going on. It's sort of, if I can let that thought die out.
Yeah, it's Another thing that Reggie Ray said in one of his talks I listened to, he said like when these kind of these very strong feelings come up, and often for me, like some of these feelings, the underlying part of it for me is a little bit of shame, because I think, you know, in our culture, but also, you know, kind of the way I was raised a little bit was like, you know, certain feelings are good to have and certain feelings are bad to have. And if I have those bad feelings, which are normal human feelings, then I should be, you know, like, that's bad, so I should be ashamed of that. So it's really, I've been really interesting watching, kind of like what you're saying, is like, so he said, like, when these strong feelings arise, instead of, like, pushing them away or, like, running away or, like, getting lost in them, hold it like you would a newborn baby. So, like, you're holding it just enough, not squeezing it, not too tight, not too loose, but just, like, so I thought for some reason that, like, really rang true to me. Like, just hold, and so I've been trying to hold, like, these more difficult feelings and, like, this feeling of this sort of, like, almost undetectable sense of shame. I don't know if anyone else has that. Like, it's sort of like, you know, like, just feel this feeling that, where does it feel? And trying not to, like, drop it or squeeze it too tightly. So, I don't know. Yeah, thanks.
For some reason, what you were saying reminded me of, so I've been reading the translation of Tenzin Gyokun, the letter to Tenzin. It's a book called How to Cook Your Life, which you want to read. It's a good book. At one point, Kurgan, he speaks of a story of Tenzin. He just sort of, the sensor just makes note of it. He goes back to cooking, and he just talks about, like, you know, like this beautiful bodhisattva figure shows up, and then what is this sensor doing? He goes back to cooking, and going into a little bit of soup. And, like, you know, this sort of just making a note of it, and like, okay, like, even in this, you know, extreme example. And I thought that actually was his natural domain as a tensor, just as an activity, even, you know, in the face of, like, extreme, like, death or people suffer, like, you know, these sorts of things. So for some reason it just reminded me of that. One of these great thoughts, various things people have said, but what you were saying about what Reggie Ray does. So I'm going to, but anyway, reminding me a lot of what Thich Nhat Hanh says about emotion. He talks about, I think when he's speaking of anger, he talks about cooking potatoes, about how it takes some time. If you put them in the water and it kind of cooks for a while and then it's soft enough and it's fine. You can't do it in the first or second. And he also talks about just sort of, you know, when an emotion comes up, just smiling to it and like, letting it be there, which reminded me also of this analogy of these emotions and things as fire, as a burning fire, some fire that's burning it, this natural thing it is. But that a fire needs oxygen, needs fuel in order to burn it, and sort of by letting it, by not actively feeding it, fuel it burns itself out. So that's been very helpful for me in the emotions. It's just that, you know, often these compositive things, you know, they dissipate when they're not, when the conditions are not being put together for them to be there. And so just sort of like, you know, allowing a thing to arise and go of its own accord, because it doesn't have the energy to sustain itself. It's just sort of, or if it does, it does, but it's not. Forcing it along. The really harder thing that I've been doing recently is that a lot of the emotions, for whatever reason, come up. I never really realized how much anxiety runs through my life, quite often. And the thing I was speaking earlier about this today, about how Zazen, when you sit, if something's in there, it's going to bubble up. So just very directly facing the mentality. And so for me, often it's been these like really deep sort of anxiety and panic feelings. They're very raw, really, really hard to deal with sometimes.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about what you're saying is, like, we would usually think that that's our foreign domain, this raw sort of anger and energy. And I think what this is saying is actually that can be your natural habitat if you are looking at it as your feelings and your feelings, or you're taking that backward step and letting the light shine in. So all these things that we usually think of as, like you're saying with preferences, these are bad, these are, you know, something we should not, actually they're arising for a reason, you know, they're coming up, and this is our home, is to look at these and to practice with them, ventilate them maybe, and then let them pass through us and wait for the next thing to happen. So I think we're almost out of time, right? So thank you very much for letting things emerge today. I kind of thought it would be interesting to get more of a discussion going, so thank you very much. I really appreciate that. So.